sun came up now so you can see me.
Yeah, right.
That's well, were you there before?
She was plunged in darkness.
Oh, is that Nancy?
Yeah, right.
She wasn't there.
But she was?
No.
No, it was funny. It was just like
this
dark picture.
No, she came.
You were there, really?
Yes.
She was?
Yeah, she was.
I thought that was a joke.
She was off to the side a little bit. You had yourself off to the side?
I couldn't bear to have you guys looking at me at 4:30.
Well, see, what you don't know is that Josh is taking your image and he's projecting it up on a big screen here. You can't see it in your picture.
Nancy, he's such a tease.
Okay, well, we got to get started. It's officially 1:32. Okay, talk to you later. I'm just turning you down, that's all.
So, what time?
No, it's fine.
Okay. Can you just tell me one key word? I'm using this on a Kindle, so it doesn't have a table of contents. Is there?
So,
from chapter,
what's the question?
From where you're going.
Oh.
A keyword, a word that I can do a find for.
You have to stand that up.
Well, I'm sort of at the end of the first chapter somewhere. But then, I mean, I'm going through sequentially, but not exactly page by page in some sense. So I don't know exactly. Okay, so
don't
like,
worry about
there's
it,
a little bit left in what I have to say about the first chapter, and then we'll be doing next few chapters. Okay, ready?
Ready. We're gonna, ready to roll.
We start without chanting now?
Yeah, now the whole day we're covered.
We're covered? Yeah. Our motivation is set. Why were we doing this? Oh, yeah. We're hoping to get a good grade.
I heard you're a tough grader.
Yeah. Josh is actually going to be my grading assistant. He's keeping track of people's level of consciousness. People sleeping.
Yeah, that's why I'm facing out like this.
I don't really actually like to do my own grading. Okay, so one of the things that I described at the end of the last period, you know, how we got from Buddha to Introduction to Emptiness in a nutshell. And one of the things that we discovered in working on the insight, the third volume of the Great Treatise, is that there's one particular verse from Sutra that Tsongkhapa goes out of his way to cite three different times. Once in the Serenity section, and then both at the beginning and the end of the Insight section. And he doesn't draw attention to the fact that he's doing this, but then there aren't many other texts that he cites more than once. There's some that he cites twice, and it just sort of jumped out eventually. eventually jumped out that it's like, oh, he picked these four lines from one sutra, and he cited them actually three times. And so they very much relate to, therefore, to a key point that he's trying to make that is throughout the book, and it relates to our ball truth that we were talking about in the first part. And that is, this is the King of Concentration Sutra. Quote, if you analytically discern the lack of self in phenomena and then cultivate that analysis in meditation, this leads to the result, nirvana. There is no peace through other means. Okay, so he goes out of his way to like cite those that one stanza three different times. So he really wants to, it includes the word analysis twice, both in the first line and the second line. First, you have to like analytically identify the lack of self and phenomena. And then when you go to meditate, you're meditating on that analysis in meditation, right? So this is like a key point that Tsongkhapa is saying. It's not just that you try to analyze and understand using reason how things don't exist as they appear, but then when you go to meditate, there's like something else, secret or less dualistic or more profound, that's the object that you cultivate in meditation. He's like really emphatic that you meditate on just that analysis. You analytically meditate on that which you have understood through through analysis and reasoning and study. Okay, so when we think about analysis, as we were talking about this morning, there's these two different kinds of analytical wisdom that we need to have. One that helps you do things better, I put it in a certain way, one that helps you do things better, and one that tells you what things really are. That's what I'm going to say, conventional and ultimate analysis. It's like one has a kind of practical use, like, you know, where would be a good place to put a new building if Josh wanted to build a new building? Suppose he does. Like, should he build it right down by the pond? You know, would that be a good place? Or would that then, you know, and so forth, would the foundation sink and be like, I don't know. It's like, how will understanding emptiness help you with that problem? you're going to have somebody who knows about, like, terrain and water. And it's like, it's a practical kind of analysis. And if you just say, well, we're going to realize emptiness and see that everything's empty and then everything should work out after that. Well, it's like, the bad place to put the house and the good place are like equally devoid of inherent existence. And whatever kind of leftover existence that they have after you negate the kind of existence they seem to have is also going to be the same. You don't have any like basis, like unless you have some other kind of analysis to think about that. So you need to have this kind of practical wisdom, kind of understanding of how things exist conventionally and ability to make distinctions within that. And then you have to have at the same time an ultimate analysis that says, yeah, but what are these things really? Why? Because if you don't have that, then you become attached to these differences, the good place to put the house, the bad place to house. And like, oh, you know, what if Diana has some plan that she, what she wants to do with the good place? And then Josh and Diana like have to get split up because they can't agree on who's going to get to have their special project like in the sacred place, right? Because it's like that is the source of happiness, is having it in that place. So it's like, so you have to have ultimate analysis to understand, to keep Josh and Diana together. And then at the same time, you have to have this conventional analysis so that they don't come to hate each other when they fight over the best place to put a building. And then you also have to have conventional analysis so you can figure out what that place would be for practical purposes. So both these things are necessary. When I went to India and I studied with Genlo Sung Gyatso there, and he was a kind of a person who taught about emptiness with this sort of, I'm not sure what the right way to put it is, kind of down-to-earth kind of approach or rough-and-ready kind of style. He liked to use examples about horses and guns and wild rivers, you know, out in calm and, you know, earthy stuff, right? So when you ask him about, like, these kinds of things, what's the relationship between the two truths? He would say things like, well, if you want to know what potato to plant, you don't want to ask a philosopher. You want to ask a farmer. And I was like, well, you know, what does that mean? Why is he saying that to me? I was like, I wasn't actually wanting to plant any potatoes, you know. So I like had to think about these things for a long time. I think it's like, oh, is he saying like that at the conventional level, when you're not talking about emptiness, it's just like whatever the ordinary, you know, practical wisdom of the world is. But if that were true, then we could just like, you know, so if when in Rome, do as the Romans do, you know, here we have slaves, here we have patriarchy, here we have misogyny, here we have homophobia. It's like whatever the local practice is, we would just go along with it. We wouldn't have any basis for criticizing it or reforming it or improving it, because it's like, well, this is the way that things are done here at the conventional level. And all we get from, you know, ultimate analysis is that everything's empty. So it occurred to me that, you know, that this farmer who knows which potato is like good to save up for next year's crop to plant, and which one knows that no hope, you know, for that, we might as well go ahead and eat it now. That farmer isn't like a literal farmer. It represents that an aspect of all of our own minds that we all have, you know, a sort of ordinary, what do you say, reliable or valid, an ordinary kind of reliable conventional consciousness. We all have a kind of source of ordinary wisdom, right, within us. And that's the farmer. It's representing the farmer. It's like, if you want to know what would be helpful, to do in a certain situation. You don't want to like turn to a philosopher who's telling you when you analyze things, these things are all ultimately empty. You want to turn to somebody who can say, well, if we think about how things, you know, are working at the conventional level, this would be a more practical, helpful kind of approach than that one. And we actually have, you know, we're differently skilled in that regard. Some people know about foundations, you know, and some people know about other things. But we even if we don't know anything about cars, we have the capacity to find out about those kinds of distinctions about what's a better car, if any, to buy. Do you see what I'm saying? And we have all the sources that we need. We have sense data, and we have the capacity to reason about the data that's coming in and to critique, you know, opinions that we're receiving from other people and weigh them. And so we have the capacity to make judgments at the conventional level. And we can go ahead and do that and feel, you know, say, well, we don't have to accept whatever's established as the current convention, say, slavery, as just being objectively uncriticizable, you know, because it's in the nature of reality, because nothing's in the nature of reality, right? So it's susceptible to revision and improvement, right? We can break the frame that's been, you know, put on us as this is the way things always have been and have to be, right? But if how are we then, once we know it's possible to break the frame, we have to be able to use some conventional analysis to see what might be an appropriate refinement. Just because people always go over the mountain on this path doesn't mean, first of all, that's the best way, nor does it mean any other way that we happen to pick will necessarily be better. It might be that there's 1,000 other ways to go, and only one of them is better than the way people are going now, right? So you have to have a kind of way of evaluating and making discriminations and choices at the conventional level. Now, in order to do that, it's quite difficult. You know, one of the things is you have to have, you know, evidence from your senses that in some level you can count on, which we'll talk about later. But the other thing is, you know, in order to carry out these analyses, you have to have some ability to keep your mind focused, stable or clear. It's harder, you know, if we're very easily distractible and we start to think about something and then the phone rings or we have that little thing on the email where it beeps bings every time like a message comes in, and it's like we can't maintain an unbroken train of thought for long enough to really think the problem through, right? Or because there's a certain show coming on or whatever it is, then we're kind of like our ability to focus and have a calm, clear thinking through of a problem is compromised. And so really what you want to do is be able to move in the direction of being able to do analysis, but to do it on the basis of a stable, clear, focused kind of mind. And that's the thing. It's not just like, oh, let me make my mind very stable and clear so I won't have to like think about any of these disturbing things. Or on the other hand, let's do a lot of really complicated analysis, but we get very scattered by the complexities. Right, and sucked away to different kinds of distractions about other problems we could be analyzing. It's like there has to be this combination of some kind of stability and clarity of the consciousness, and then within that kind of stable and clear mind, carrying out some kind of practical analysis of is there a more helpful way to approach this problem or that one. Tsongkhapa says, he claims in the Great Treatise that all virtue everywhere arises from thinking about problems with all virtue at page 15 in the new second edition. All virtue everywhere can be traced back to the mental practice of reflecting on facts with an undistracted mind. So, okay, you have to think about this. I think this is like a good thing to remember and think about, to what degree do we agree with it or not. Do you know what I'm saying? I put it out there to test these words like a goldsmith type tests gold. You know, you don't have to like accept it because Tsongkhapa said it, right? But it's not something worth thinking about. All virtue arises from the mental practice of reflecting on facts with an undistracted mind. So what he's saying is like, this could include a yogi having, you know, a deep samadhi within which they're doing a deep analysis of the ultimate nature of reality, and thereby, you know, cultivating, you know, profound wisdom and insight. But he's extending, he's phrasing it intentionally in a way that includes us. It's like, we're going to have any virtue, it's going to come out of thinking about what the real situation is from within a calm, clear mind, and thinking about what the real facts of the situation is. Oh, they're facts? I thought everything was empty. You know, it's like, oh, well, there's within emptiness, there's some things that from our point of view are true, that like, this is not a cat. You know, it's like, it would be unskillful, right, to regard it as a cat, even though it's empty of cup nature and empty of cat nature. We still have to be able to say that it's a cup and not a cat. And like that, there are all kinds of facts at the conventional level. And so we have to be able to reflect on these things without grasping upon them as objectively inherently established, and makes and sort out, you know, what will be the most helpful way to act in that situation. Anyway, I'd be interested if you guys have any thoughts later about whether, to what extent you think that that all virtue arises from reflecting on facts with an undistracted mind. So what's the beginning of this process of developing a kind of deeper insight into the nature of reality on the ultimate side or the conventional side? Tsongkhapa says the first thing you have to do is study. That study is always like hearing or listening. You're studying right now. So like studying is, you know, engaging your mind with the words of the Dharma and thinking about, starting to think about it. It's like, and then you can go beyond that to introspectively reflecting on, well, what does this really mean? And how does this apply to me? And what is it like in experience? But you have to start by like trying to get the words straight, trying to sort out what the actual concepts are at this, could say at the intellectual level. So the Gelugpa order, you know, that Tsongkhapa starts by putting this forth, is known for being faithful to his teaching that study is practice, and that the path to Buddhahood requires, you know, study. Josh will remember that in the first volume, I think Tsongkhapa quotes the Gadamba master, who says, well, you can brag about the fact that you only know what's in one sadhana, or you can try to keep it secret, but it doesn't matter. Either way, you'll never become a Buddha until you've read a yak's load of books. So it's interesting. It's like, obviously, well, some people were bragging about the fact that they only read one sadhana. They took pride in, you know, avoiding discursive intellectual engagement, considering that to be antithetical to true yogic practice. Then other people might be a little bit abashed that they were, you know, didn't really know much of the Dharma except for, you know, one practice that they'd gotten from a teacher. But either way, he's saying, look, you have to like have a broad understanding of what's in the Buddhist teaching, and then think about that, make some distinctions, understand what the teaching is, and then on that basis start to fill out how does it really apply to me in my life, and then meditate on the basis of what you've understood after reflecting upon what you'd studied, and not just like, oh, all that intellectual stuff is like so low. I want to go straight to the immediate practice of highest yoga tantra without any discursive practices or bothering with any of those low Hinayana practices, like wanting to get out of cyclic existence, as though there were such a thing as cyclic existence. I, as like a profound yogi, understand that cyclic existence is empty from the very beginning. So why would I wish to cultivate any attitude of renunciation toward it and so forth? So, of course, I'm not making this up. This is not just like me hallucinating. Like, this is a real problem, of course, that's part of the whole heritage of Tibetan Buddhism from before the time of Tsongkhapa, for hundreds of years before the time of Tsongkhapa, down to today. Okay, and Tsongkhapa is saying, well, you know, we have to have a different way of thinking about what the practice is that includes, you know, everything that the Buddha taught. I just heard a story about, I would say, another guy who was teaching at a at a Western Tibetan Dharma Center associated with a different order of Tibetan Buddhism. And when he cited the Pali Canon, he had scorn heaped upon his head. Because why would we want to hear about these like low Hinayana practices? You know, we have these tantras that we practice, and those teachings were obviously given for people who are much lower than us. And the teacher said, well, I guess the word of Buddha isn't good enough for you guys. In other words, we didn't take it lightly. And then there was a, you know, fight between the teacher and the crowd. So first you have to study a yak's load of books. What texts are important in this yak's load of book? And now we're definitely over into chapter 2. What texts would you study in the second edition? Starts on page 20. Well, this is the distinction that comes up between the provisional and the definitive, or you could say that which requires interpretation and the definitive. This distinction, you know, goes back to the very, very early days of Buddhism when, you know, Buddha made many different kinds of statements. You know, Buddha told Jataka stories in which Buddha told about past lifetimes, and then he said, and I was that deer, you know, and so forth like that. And then there's no mention about emptiness or there not being an inherently existent person, you know, it's just a story about how you should be more generous or something like that. And he speaks about people and talks about himself as I and so forth. So there's no critique of the concept of a self. There's a different kind of moral lesson. And then, of course, then there's so many other teachings where Buddha is saying, well, you know, what you think as a person is something more like a marionette, you know, that's doesn't have any pith or core or essence of the sort that you're constantly clinging to and believing in, right? And so then when you get to the next generation, people are trying to organize this and put this together, and they're saying, okay, you know, Buddha said lots of different kinds of things. How are we to understand that sometimes, you know, he speaks about a person, he speaks about himself, he speaks in the first person, and he seems to take for granted these kinds of things exist, and then in other times he's specifically saying that they're completely unfindable, and that anybody who believes in them is bound in the realm of death. Right? So this gave rise to different ways of thinking about this, and sometimes people talked about the idea of the definitive and the interpretable, you know, things that were represented the final definitive meaning or the ultimate truth to which Buddha was pointing, and things that were conventionally useful or reliable and helpful, but didn't represent the final and definitive truth. So from the beginning, there was this kind of link, even, you know, no matter how you look at it, between the ultimate truth and the texts that are definitive, and conventional truth and texts that are provisional. So that is one way of understanding, you know, what texts are ultimately the final definitive texts that we should rely on. It's the texts that are considered definitive are the ones that teach the final nature of reality, which is not susceptible to further interpretation, because it's like when you ask of anything, what is it really? That's at last what you come to, and that's emptiness. So according to Tsongkhapa, the definitive texts are the texts of the second turning of the wheel, which teach that everything, everywhere, always lacks any graspable intrinsic nature and is completely empty. Buddha is empty, the path is empty, the person is empty, the mind is empty, all different dimensions, any subtle part of the mind that you can think of or posit or point out, empty of intrinsic nature. Everything exists only through interconnection of various sorts, which we'll talk about later. But nothing exists by its own power, in and of itself, from its own side. It only exists as something seen from a certain point of view in the context of interrelationship with causes and conditions, okay? Whereas things that taught, you know, the other sutras are interpretable. Now this, you know, that they say something and we can understand it, but we have to understand that in terms of the ultimate meaning of reality, there's something deeper. Now, this way of interpreting what texts are definitive is that the ones that teach finally, ultimately, everything is empty, in the second turning of the wheel of Dharma, those are the definitive ones. That is taught in sutra. That is, you have a Mahayana sutra where Buddha says, oh, which of my teachings are interpretable and which are definitive? And that's the explanation of Akshayamati Sutra, in which Buddha says, oh, the ones where I teach that that everything is empty as the final nature of reality, those are the definitive, and the other ones are the interpretable. So you think, well, that ought to settle it, that the definitive ones are definitely ones that the Buddha in the sutra said were the definitive ones. He's got a Metta Sutra, where he's like explaining which of your sutras you should take as the final ones and which is the penultimate ones. But there's a problem. And there's other sutras in which Buddha gave other ways of deciding which were the final and interpretable. And the Sandhi Nirmochana Sutra, Buddha gives a different interpretation of what's interpretable and what's definitive, in which the text of the sutras of the third turning of the wheel are the definitive ones. And those are ones that teach, as you may know, about like a foundational mind, a foundational awareness, or we used to say mind basis of all, an alaya vijnana. It's like that this is something that's not empty of its own nature, but what people are trapped in cyclic existence because they don't understand that these appearances of subject and object that are constantly rising before us and thinking of that they're different entities, that actually all of this is of one nature, one entity of the mind, this foundational awareness. And people, failing to realize that, grasp after these objects as though they were apart from themselves and are trapped in cyclic existence. And so if you realize these things as ultimately non-dual and of one entity with the mind, then in the third turning of the wheel way, you know, you'll be free from cyclic existence. Well, the problem with that from this point of view of Tsongkhapa and the text, the sutras he considers interpretable, is that you're reifying the mind itself. As a self-existent entity that's not itself being, you're saying this mind exists in and of itself and a sense of awareness and an object separate from it or arising from this foundation, but you're not critiquing the foundational awareness itself and saying, well, you know, how real is that? Okay. So there's something that's being grasped after. So at Lehigh, His Holiness brought this problem up and he's saying, well, you know, we want to know which sutras we can rely on as definitive and which ones are interpretable. Seems like a good person to turn to for help with that would be the Buddha. So let's see what the Buddha said about it. Well, he said two contradictory things. So we have one sutra where he says these sutras are definitive and another sutra where he says those other ones are definitive and these aren't. So what we'll need a Metta Sutra to tell us which of the hermeneutic sutras to rely upon to know which of the other sutras and you know, His Holiness was almost like making a joke out of it. He's saying, you know, well, there'll be no end of sutras that you'll need to explain which other sutras that you'll need to rely on. And so he said, well, what's the answer? You have to analyze. You'll have to think about it. You know, I have to think about, well, when we analyze what is the nature of reality, which of these solutions seems to really work for us? Obviously, Tsongkhapa thinks that the right answer is that when you finally understand that there isn't anything that holds up under analysis, when you say with regard to it, what is this really? You don't find anything that holds its own nature or essence from its own side, including some you know, idea of a deep foundational awareness, that you'll realize that the Akshayamati Nirdesha Sutra is right, and the Sandhi Nirmochana Sutra itself has to be interpreted when it says that those other ones are interpretable, right? but, you know, you could think that, you know, Buddha teaches all these things for a purpose, and they've been very popular and influential in India and Tibet and in East Asia, and that there are many people who, if you just say, as we were talking about in first class, you know, the emptiness is not the best marketing tool for everybody. And that some people, when you say, oh, everything's empty, and then they start to think about it, it's hard for them to maintain any confidence that anything they do makes any difference and that actions have consequences and that, you know, they have to. And it's like just everything dissolves into emptiness. And so that there's there are really a lot of Buddhists, a lot of Mahayana Buddhists have in different ways integrated these Yogacara or Chittamatra teachings about like the mind as the basis of things, rather than emptiness as the baselessness of things, the philosophical foundation for Buddhist practice. You could say, like, you know, if the choice is falling into nihilism or believing in Yogacara, it's pretty clear that, you know, Buddha has provided a philosophy, right, that can be helpful, and it's not just being made up from somewhere else. So we reason about these things based on evidence and see how far we can take the matter, and maybe at some point we'll arrive at these kinds of conclusions that everything is ultimately empty. Now, within this, this is the second chapter of Introduction to Emptiness. Tsongkhapa says, well, you know, this is the part of Buddha's word that I take as definitive, because it points to that ultimate empty nature of things beyond which no further interpretation is possible. And so the person who explains that in the reliable way is Nagarjuna and his followers. So Nagarjuna and Aryadeva, his disciple. And then he says, well, you know, there's these other Madhyamakas, but among all the other Madhyamakas, the ones that, you know, I suggest that you rely upon are Buddhapalita and Chandrakirti and Shantideva. That is, people that he considers clear-cut in the Prasangika line, which means, you know, not including people who have mixed Yogacara at some level into Madhyamaka, like Gyanagarbha or Kamala Shila or Shantarakshita, and not people like Bhava Viveka. So he's like saying, well, these are important Madhyamaka thinkers, and he quotes these people, especially Kamala Shila, quite a lot. But as far as the final view, he's going to say, you know, these are the people, Chandrakirti and Buddhapalita and Shantideva, who really understood what Nagarjuna was saying, and Nagarjuna is the person who really understood what the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras were teaching. Okay, so he quotes Chandrakirti on page 24, at the top of page 24. He says, it's said that you become attached to things by the power of an afflictive misunderstanding, an afflictive misknowledge, a wrong thought that is an affliction, a delusion, a consciousness that superimposes an essence of things, and that one stops cyclic existence by totally stopping that, totally stopping that kind of delusion. By seeing objects as lacking intrinsic existence, you totally stop the seed of cyclic existence, the consciousness that causes attachment. So there he's saying, look, this is what Chandrakirti says, you know, the ultimate nature of things is this lack of intrinsic existence. Realizing this lack of intrinsic existence is the antidote that will lead us out of cyclic existence. The antidote to cyclic existence is not to stop thinking. Right, the antidote to cyclic existence is not to realize something that other than emptiness. Let's say it's not to know anything other than emptiness. We can say, you know, when we think about it and describe what is it that one's trying to understand, it is specifically this lack or absence. It's interesting because, you know, if you're like a yogi, you know, realizing nirvana and you're having this non-dualistic experience of ultimate reality, you're not sitting around thinking, oh, this is what emptiness is like. And you're not thinking, oh, now I finally realize emptiness. And you're not thinking, oh, emptiness really does exist. And no, you don't have, there's nothing that appears other than emptiness. And there's not even any sense of emptiness appearing to the mind, that there's a mind and emptiness is appearing to it. It's like, unlike that. The mind is of the nature of emptiness, and all you're tuned into like a level of awareness where all you're seeing is the final nature of reality. So there's no sense of like separation between me who's seeing ultimate reality and the ultimate reality I'm seeing. It's just open space of emptiness without any place in it that you're standing looking at this space, because you're also empty. See what I'm saying? So Because of that, like some people criticizing Tsongkhapa said, well, your idea that the yogis realizing emptiness doesn't make any sense, because that's not how the yogi sees it at all. They don't see themselves as sitting there seeing emptiness. They're having an experience that is utterly beyond any words or description or conceptualization. If you think, oh, I'm seeing emptiness, or this is emptiness, then that's clearly not it. That's like another like dualistic thought. Now, instead of grasping onto real existence, you've grasped onto emptiness, and you should like stop all that grasping onto thoughts. And so what does Tsongkhapa say to that? You know, he can say, well, look, that's right, is that ultimately, if you want to have like the wisdom that's like the real fire that burns up the seeds of cyclic existence, you have to have this kind of non-dualistic experience, but it's not devoid of any content. It's true that the mind at that time does not think there's the content and there's me, but it's not just like a vacuous state. As one emerges from the state, the yogi, according to Tsongkhapa, can look back and say, oh, I've realized the profound nature of reality. And the yogi can think about what she's realized and say things about it, which are not never captured exactly, but they can say things that are conventionally correct about what happened. Emptiness does indeed exist. You know, I, as a conventionally existent person, have realized emptiness. And these become statements that, you know, do not capture the ineffable experience of non-dual realization, but they're conventionally correct statements about that experience. And so there he says, like so we're not able to capture in words what these experiences is like, but at the level of doing philosophy and trying to say something that makes sense, that gets us prepared to realize ultimate reality, let's say something that's accurate, rather than just saying, well, it's inconceivable, and just make people think that if they would stop conceiving of things, then they would be in good shape. I mean, there's two factors here. It's like the mode in which you're knowing and what you're knowing, you know? It's like the mode of knowing is like we're always knowing things dualistically and we're not knowing the right stuff. We're misthinking. Okay? So we've got two problems, because Buddha is non-conceptual and sees emptiness. We don't see emptiness and we're always conceptualizing. Okay? So which is the bigger problem? You know? Well, Tsongkhapa says like dualistic thinking is itself not the root of cyclic existence. And basically, it's one of the main things we've got to use right now, given where we are, to try to get at the root of cyclic existence. So don't attack that. That's like, oh, you know, like Buddha, does, like if somebody's going to say, go to war in order to achieve peace, the first thing they do is not throw down their sword. Like that's the idea. It's like a bodhisattva is going to war against the enemies of ignorance and delusion and hatred and fear. The first thing is not to disarm yourself, right? You have to, you ultimately, you're beyond all dualistic conceptions in your way of understanding things, but you're not knowing nothing. You're knowing, you're realizing in that non-dualistic way some the profound reality of things as utterly devoid of anything graspable. At least that's how it looks from our point of view. You know what I'm saying? It's not that the yogi who's having that experience at that time says that, but they can look back, according to Tsongkhapa, they can look back on their experience and say, well, that's something that we can say about it. It wasn't nothing. Mm. Okay. Then we come to this issue about the self of persons and self of phenomena and the general idea of selflessness. Tsongkhapa spends a lot of time in volume 3 trying to identify what is it that emptiness is the opposite of. If you're trying to realize emptiness and you're using reasoning, then you're negating something, the thing that emptiness is the lack of. And what is that thing? And a lot of the big chunk of volume 3 is about exactly that. But it's not just an intellectual exercise. It's a process of overcoming, you know, certain kinds of ignorance or delusion that, you know, we have. And those are existing things. Intrinsic existence doesn't exist, but the delusion that we are real, that plagues us all the time and is very existent. So you can say there's two kinds of objects of negation, right? There's what you get rid of, the delusion that exists and that we try to clean up on the path, right? And then there's that falsely superimposed self that that delusion believes in, which never exists, never has existed, never could exist, right? You can't make it go out of existence because it never existed in the first place. But what you can do is negate it in the sense of proving its non-existence and thereby refuting the delusion that believes in it, right? So first he's like talking about this sense. It's like, what is that? What kinds of wrong thoughts or delusions or is the path getting rid of? And he's like, there's a conception of self of persons and there's a conception of self of phenomena, okay? So there are a lot of Madhyamakas and other people who say that the conception of self of persons is somehow, in one way or another, a little more superficial. And the conception of self of phenomena is like a deeper, more profound type of emptiness. Other people say that, not Tsongkhapa, not Chandrakirti. But other Madhyamakas say like that sometimes, okay? Well, their idea is is based on what I was explaining just in the morning. That is that, you know, when you look at, if you meditate and say you do Vipassana meditation or something like that, you observe your own experience and you say, well, I was believing in this kind of self, but then when I watch what's really here, I never seem to like have the kind of self that I believed in that I thought I had, but I do notice these other things. And if I get my concentration really deep, I can notice these really, really tiny moments of experience. And I can't seem to notice anything smaller than that. Like when I take, there's this thing called taking a step. And when I watch it really closely, I see like 1,000 things in the course of a step, you know. But I don't see anything smaller than that. You know, there's a point that's like this. And so it must be a person is like a delusion that we grasp onto, a superimposition. And it's made out of all these subtle phenomena that are real. So then taking that kind of line of thinking that I was, you know, putting forth in the first class, some people say, well, it must be therefore then that the conception of self about persons is a coarse kind of emptiness, and that the subtle emptiness is the one that shows that even these little tiny phenomena are all empty too, because even they only exist as collections of parts that happen to be too small for us to see, and they only arise in dependence on other things and don't have their own power built into themselves to exist. So Tsongkhapa disagrees with that and bases himself on Chandrakirti instead. And Chandrakirti says, no, like the profound emptiness is the same in regard to now you could have you could realize a coarse kind of emptiness about persons or a coarse kinds of emptiness about tables and chairs. But emptiness is emptiness. And in the only difference between the emptiness of the lack of self in persons and the lack of self of phenomena is whether you're talking about a person or a table or a chair or a leg or a knee or, a mind. A mind is like, you know, a moment of consciousness is like a part, an aspect of a person, not a person. And so the emptiness of consciousness is like the complete lack of any intrinsic nature in that moment of consciousness. And the emptiness of the person is just the same kind of emptiness, but in relationship to a different basis, you know, that you're talking about as being empty. So anyway, that's kind of an important point to Tsongkhapa. And this is sort of becomes part of the basis for him saying that you don't have to be a bodhisattva to realize the profound emptiness. You know, the profound, that there are, look, you have these categories of beings called arhats, you know, who are not bodhisattvas, but they're supposed to have gotten completely free from cyclic existence. Well, how did they get completely free from cyclic existence? They didn't realize emptiness. They had to realize the profound emptiness in order to eradicate the root of cyclic existence, and they did that without becoming bodhisattvas. And therefore, you know, there must be a way that that you can realize this, you know, without being in the bodhisattva path. So that's the way that Chandrakirti and Tsongkhapa goes. Now, when we talk about this like emptiness or lack of self of persons, lack of self of a phenomena, it's the same thing as emptiness. It's just a different way of saying it. The self, when you say lack of self in persons or lack of self in phenomena, the self that's being negated it's not a self that's another word for person. It's a self that means like an intrinsically real thing, nature that's there. So it's like when you say lack of self and phenomena, well, I never thought that the table had a self in the first place, right? But they're using the word self to refer to the idea of like an intrinsic nature that's established from the side of the person or the object. And this is equally negated with regard to all persons and all non-persons, anything that exists. Okay? So in the case of people, what does our lack of self mean? How bad is the news for us as people, right? I was saying to Diana yesterday, it doesn't mean we don't have distinctive personalities, right? I like to like point out that like it's not just like there is a Buddha and we will all be it. There are lots of enlightened beings, and they have all different kinds of forms and shapes and colors and personalities and ornaments. And at least if you know, some sutras seem to suggest that some of them have like certain kinds of aptitudes that are, you know, stronger than other ones in some ways, right? Based on the kinds of things that they did or the vows that they made before they were enlightened. So like, it's like not that there's like, oh, if you're awakened, you have to have a certain kind of personality. Isn't that, that's interesting. I was like, well, you're not acting very Buddhist. Your personality is inadequately Buddhist, sir. Must be more serene. And there's lots of different kinds of, you know, ways of being awakened. So that's the, I think that's the good news, is that there are people and persons who exist, and they can have like sort of some kind of continuum of propensity to, you know, manifest that express that personhood in distinctive ways. But what there isn't is any kind of like what we actually think we have, and that is sort of any core nature that or pith of being, right? Any essentially real soul that's back of our mind and body, that's the real us. I don't know, you know, it's like there's lots of different ways to approach this. We really strongly want to believe in this and hold on to it. And it is like that, the core, maybe that's one of the big marketing problems, right, of Buddhism. That's why it's like pulling your hair the wrong way, is that like saying, oh, well, things are empty, and that's another way of saying you don't, you know, you're not the person you think you are. Yeah, and it's like, oh, that's very frightening to people, right? And it's true, as you get into emptiness, there is the sense of like the ground giving way beneath you, or you, I mean, people might have sense of, you know, sort of a dissolving of the person that they think they are. Of course, this is one of the problems, you know, in doing this, because we all bring our different kinds of psychopathology to the Dharma Center. Some people already are unsure who they are before they get here. And somebody's like, oh, yeah, Buddha's definitely right. I have no idea who I am. You know? Or people come, like, they have a sense of who they are, but it includes you. And it's like, yeah. You know, it's like, everything they assimilate into what they think is their self, everything that they think is going on inside your mind, right? You know, sort of lack of any kind of realistic, conventional sense of boundary between this person and that person. There's all kinds of problems. And, you know, this is so it's important then to think about, like, well, I thought we were supposed to have a healthy self in Western psychology, right? And how are we going to have a healthy psychological self if they keep talking about this as no self? People are trying to destroy it. The Dharma Center is trying to destroy yourself or get you to stop believing in it, you know, and the therapist is trying to help you rebuild it from all the damage that was done in your childhood. Yeah. You know, Harvey has written a bunch about that, you know, in Buddhist practice on Western ground. That's a good thing to read about that. But, you know, you absolutely have to make a really clear distinction between what's being talked about and a psychological self that the therapists are talking about is not a claim of some self-existent being that exists objectively from its own side, right? It's getting an idea that's what I would say a realistic conventional sense of what it means for me to be a person. And that's what they're, you know, as distinct from another person in relationship with another person, right? Able to be in a relationship with another person because I know where I begin and the other person ends, and then we can like have a sense of interconnection. That's and it's like, so if you don't have any conventional sense of who you are, then it just gets, this idea of no self just gets very confusing and difficult for you. I think, you know, I think that's like one, it's one of a number of reasons why some people say, well, the teaching on emptiness is the best medicine for people who are ready and poison for people who aren't. You know, don't teach it to everybody, right? You can teach love is, you know, teach love and compassion can be good medicine for everybody, especially if you teach it properly. I've always wondered, it's like, well, if you teach love and compassion to somebody who doesn't love themselves, and you just start saying, oh, you should go out and you should stop cherishing yourself so much. Go start cherishing other people. Well, if that person is already in like a codependent mode and they don't actually love themselves at all, and they're trying to fill up that hole by going around taking care of other people, then they haven't really, that you may actually be harming them. But if you do like the metta way, you know, and say, look, our cherishing, you know, we are one of the people who deserves to be happy. We wish welfare for ourselves. I am a person for whom it is suitable to wish happiness. I am not a person who deserves to be punished a priori. I have no essential nature of badness, but rather, may I be well, you know, and then you say, oh yeah. And all these other beings, you know, they wish for happiness and causes of happiness too. And let's, you know, from a basis of, you know, respecting and caring for myself, let's just see how big we can make that circle of care grow, right? So anyway, leaving aside that point, the general teaching and, you know, that they usually say in the Tibetan tradition is love is good medicine for everybody. Emptiness is the best medicine for some, but poison for the people who aren't ready. And that's why. Is because, like, if you, it's not like, for some people, it can make them more confused. And some people have even written articles talking about it as like validating psychopathology by having like a teacher say, you know, oh, your symptoms are actually attainments. You see what I'm saying? So when we talk about the self, the self of no self, the self that when we say there's no self of persons, it doesn't exist at all, even conventionally. It's this idea of a exaggerated, reified self, right? When we say, okay, well, what about a person? Well, a person exists conventionally, but not ultimately, right? So when you look at from the point of view of emptiness, and you say, "From in emptiness there is no eye, no ear, no tongue, no body, and so forth." Well, it didn't say those things don't exist at all. So from an ultimate point of view, from within the framework of emptiness, none of these things exist at all, right? But it doesn't say they don't exist at all in general. They don't exist from the point of view of looking at things from in terms of emptiness, in terms of what their ultimate nature is. Okay. Okay, so as we were mentioning a minute ago, if analysis is going to refute this superimposed, deluded kind of self, we first have to identify the object of negation, the target, what it is that, you know, you're actually, and this is a key point for some, just the idea of, we're not going to just start analyzing and see what gets wiped out. We have to sort of understand, well, what is this analysis actually trying to critique or, I guess the idea is, like, if you're not careful when you're doing this analysis and you don't really know what it's trying to refute, it's too easy to refute too much or too little. But especially he's worried about too much, right? Like somebody says, like this, you know, when I look for this cup, you know, I say, like, well, what is the cup really? You know, obviously I could pick it up and take a drink out of it, but it's like, yeah, what is it really? And I look at the different parts of the cup and I don't find the cup in any of its parts, nor I can imagine all the parts of the cup, you know, in a big collection, like when I ordered a bookcase and they sent this collection of bookcase parts, but it wasn't like anything that I could put bookcase on. You get cups. You could, you know, order a cup today. Oh, here's a bunch of clay and some glaze, and you can put it together yourself. So you have a complete collection of cup parts is not suitable as a cup, and you can have like something that's in the shape of a cup and still not necessarily a cup. So you can't really like find the cup in the shape or the color or the individual parts or the collection of the parts of the cup. It's like, this is a little spooky. And, you know, the cup seems to be there, but when I analyze it, I don't find the cup that I thought was there when I looked in or among the parts of the cup for the cup. And so Tsongkhapa says, yeah, when people realize that in meditation, then they think, I could apply that same analysis to myself as the analyzer. And if the analyzer is also refuted in the same way the cup is, then don't I kind of have a paradox there? It's like, how am I doing analysis if there's no analyzer or possibility of doing any analysis, because all analysis and all analyzers are just as empty as all cups? What am I going to say? And he says, like, then people just go, well, I guess we can't say anything. Nothing exists. Nothing doesn't exist. It's like, whatever we say is wrong. We're just going to have to stop talking. But maybe we'll like say some things in a pretend way, you know, to try to help other people stop talking. You see what I'm saying? Like that. And he says, well, you know, you could do like that, but Tsongkhapa thinks that's not the most helpful thing to do. You know, from his point of view, he thinks that, you know, what you should say is that, like, well, it's clear that even though we cannot find the cup when we search for it under analysis, it's still just able to hold the tea. And in the same way, even though I can't find myself as the analyzer of the cup, I'm still able to do the analysis. It's a mystery, but somehow stuff is working, even though when you go out to look for it, you can't ever pin down exactly what it is. And so it's obviously not being totally destroyed or obliterated by this analysis that searches out, you know, what it is and comes up with only emptiness. I gave this example in Introduction to Emptiness of like going into my class and sitting on the table, right? That's a true story, right? I assume if you read that. So I went into class one day and I can't sit on this table, right? But we were like, you know, have tables in the front of the classroom. And so I just go into the classroom and sit up on top of the table. So I can sit semi cross-legged and like see all the students. And I just did this for months, even for semesters, you know, with this same table, and it never wobbled or anything. Maybe I was gaining a lot of weight. I don't know. But anyway, the table was aging invisibly also, you know. And so one day I just went in and sat on the table, and there wasn't a table. That was like the last moment of the table. It was like there wasn't anything recognizable like as that you could even begin to imagine reconstituting as a table. It's a little hard to describe. The thing just shattered. Yeah, it didn't just like, it wasn't like a leg fell. No. It was like debris. It was a debris field. Okay? I was like, oh, there was a table here before. And now there's just debris. Right? So, like, obviously this was surprising to me. And I was like, well, why am I surprised? Was I thinking that that was a permanent table? I didn't ever notice the moment in which I thought, oh, that table is permanent. Right? I was trying to, like, think of that when I came to the retreat house, you know, and I was thinking, it looks very similar, you know. I guess I was sort of thinking that that it would, you know, it's that it's permanent, you know. It will always be as it has been. And more or less it seems to be living up to that. I consider this as a stable Pure Land. But, you know, yeah, that we have these conceptions that our friends and the people we know and the tables, you know, we sort of are shocked when they age or change or break or die and fall apart. It's like, well, why are we surprised? Because at some level, our expectations about what they are and what they will be have built into them this kind of sense of continuity or stability or permanence. You know, it would be interesting to say, what would it be like, you know, to have a conception of a person that fully took into account and anticipated, you know, that how they would be aging and dying and being completely unsurprised, you know, that a person would die. That's like interesting. I think if you like, maybe, you know, like if you, well, usually we don't think about dying so much, you know, but if you mix your mind with dying a lot, then when you see a being, then you think, oh, another mortal one. maybe, right? That's what I think. It's like if you come out of a hospital, you know, I think it was like, all of these beings are vulnerable to being in the hospital. But then after a while, you stop thinking like that. And they're all just like, oh, you're sick? Especially me. I don't, you know, it's like, you know, you forget about being sick until you're sick, right? Mm. So the point is that we have this kind of, in this case, I'm talking about permanence, really. We have the kind of distorted, latent, hidden, lurking misconception about how things exist that's built into how we're interacting with them, right? And thinking of them as having more solidity and permanence than they do, right? And so if we want to like see that, oh, these things aren't really like that, it's helpful to bring to the surface, oh, we really do have this false notion. You know, we must have believed in something that's like really clearly and obviously wrong, counterfactual, continuously contradicted by readily available evidence, and yet I just kind of like seem to just keep going along believing it all the time anyway, right? It must be fulfilling some very strong need, because it's not, you know, I haven't ever met anybody who didn't die, yet I keep being surprised when the people do, right? So, yeah, if we were meeting a lot of immortal people, then, you know, you would think, oh, that one's mortal, but... So, like, we have, and like that, it's like that with emptiness, too, right? This is the idea I'm saying. If you want to understand how things are empty, you have to, like, introspectively go through some process whereby you identify in your own mind what it feels like to believe in or grasp onto this reified sense of self. And this is actually very difficult. It's harder than talking about it, right? It's a lot of, you know, you have to like do a practice whereby you can conjure up a vivid, you know, reified, exaggerated sense of self, but at the same time, you're spying on yourself and catching yourself having this exaggerated sense of self. Well, I sat down this morning and tried to think of like, well, who am I right now? And I concluded that I was a sort of a barbell-shaped density that extends from my head to my solar plexus, and it kind of thins out in the middle, and the biggest part of it's right here. And I was like, oh, well, I'm sure that that's essentially real. But anyway, so, you know, you can go around and say, like, well, when I say my hand, where's the eye that owns the hand? When somebody smashes your hand, then, oh, you hit me, so then me moved out into the fingers, and like... And so then it's a very elusive sense of who we really are. It's worthwhile to think about that and play with it and reflect upon not just how we talk about it, which is interesting in itself, but like how it feels, what to watch, who it is that we think we are. And then, of course, like the cases that are usually brought to our attention to focus on are cases where people are accusing you of things or, you know, are attacking you in some way, and it's like, you know, you're saying that about me. And then the sense of indignant outrage or something like that like rises up very forcefully, and it could be, you know, that, you know, that something really wrong has occurred, and that's, I'm not saying that it's okay and you should passively bear, you know, outrageous treatment because to be a good Buddhist at all, right? No, it's just like, what's interesting is that when someone's, you know, sort of falsely accusing you of something, is to separate out, okay, well, that was an error in their perspective and what can be done about it, from the part is like, that comes up. I always feel like it's that little monster from Alien. Yeah. Little alien monster. I've got one of those. It comes out like, you know, right about here. Yeah. So, like, I think about this, and like, and actually, I didn't make this up. I got it from someone, from Kathy Rogers, is thinking about this as an analogy of cognitive therapy, where, you know, the idea is that some people suffer unnecessarily because they have internalized, they've swallowed some poison from their childhood, a cognitive poison. They swallowed a wrong thought. They've bought it hook, line, and sinker. That, you know, you're no good, you'll never amount to anything, you're too fat, you know, you're the weak link in this family, or you know, you're just a klutz, or whatever. There's a lot of different things, you know, that people get from their peers or their parents or their siblings or whatever. And it's like, of course everybody gets, you know, something. The question isn't whether you buy it. And if you buy it or buy into it at some level, then you've swallowed that poison thought, you know, and it's like becomes part of who you are. And then it's like, it affects you for the rest of your life. And it's like the idea is that, like, well, in order to fix this, you first have to find out that you have the thought. You have to find out that you're holding on to that idea, right, about who you are. And then if you can say, oh, well, you know, this is the message I got, you know, when I was young, and I guess at some level I do think it's true. And if you can hold that in your mind, then you can say, okay, well, what's the actual evidence for it now as things are today? To what degree is it consistent with how the conventional reality really is? You know, and if it is somewhat, then are there things you want to do about it? It's not that it's intrinsic to your nature, right, to be exactly the way people were saying, you know. Yeah. So like that, you know, we have a false thought, that a wrong thought that we've swallowed from beginningless time, that's the source of infinite needless misery, right? This thought that things that we exist in and of ourselves. And you can't really attack it accurately and precisely unless you've identified that you hold it, which, as I say, this is like not an intellectual thing, but like a meditative process of trying to find yourself in the act of like imagining yourself as feel what it feels like to have that I monster, you know, operating. So on page 29, I sort of get into this idea that once you identify this, then it allows you to do analysis in a way that tries to avoid going too far, avoid negating too much. If you know what it is that you're eliminating, is that this wrong thought that's the subtle root of cyclic existence, then your analysis can take, you know, say, like, this is the target that we're trying to work against, is this kind of self that's conceived of by this ignorance. And so the middle way, negating just enough, but not negating too much, is very difficult. You know, like one example, I think it might have come from a book by this one, but I'm not sure. It's like thinking of it as like a ridge. I don't know, I've been using it for a long time. Like the way I imagine, I have two ways of thinking of the middle way. It's like one is like a ridge, and there's a slope like this, and then there's a cliff, and so, but like there's this really narrow ridge along the top where you're going along through life, going along through the path, having not falling either to the extreme of exaggerating how real things are, nor to the extreme of, you know, negating things that actually do exist. So right now we're over on the extreme of constantly reflexively exaggerating how real things are. This is how we come to be trapped in cyclic existence. We're not people aren't born innately nihilistic, you know. People are developed with this tendency to grasp onto themselves. So you have to like gradually like negate more and more subtle forms of this sense of self. That's like going up this this sloped side to the ridge. And you want to go as far as you can out toward the edge of the cliff without falling over. Because that's like, it's like a razor's edge there of like negating every single last trace of reified sense of how things exist without actually eliminating the kind of existence that's there. So it's very difficult, right? And you know, as Holiness is talking about, well, you know, if you're going to make a mistake, you make a mistake on the side of, you know, where we're coming from, and not go over the cliff into nihilism. But if you don't go far enough, you never get to the root of cyclic existence. If you can get to the root of cyclic existence, the subtlest root form of reification, then that eliminates all of the other artificial. Like, if you don't believe that there's any, if you come to realize that there's no essentially existent self that's there from its own side, then you're not going to believe in a permanent self or an immortal self, you know, and other kinds of, you know, a substantial self. Any kind of idea that exaggerated idea that we might have about things will be wiped out when you get to the root that's behind them all. The other way that I've thought about this, and I think I may have made it up myself, I don't remember, is to think about it as like surgery. It's like we have this therapeutic situation, right, where you're trying to be healed, and it's like you have, we have a sense, I think the table exists, and Tsongkhapa is telling me that I'm right. So I'm not really worried. He says that it doesn't have intrinsic existence, but I don't really know what that means. It's maybe like this water bottle is something extra that I'm supposed to be adding on, and he tells me to take it off. So I'm okay. And I don't really care about the table that much. What I'm really talking about is me, you know. This is like, it's like inherently existent guy. Oh, guy's okay. Guy exists. Guy's a person. Guy has a personality. Guy exists conventionally. You know, and so that's another way of saying guy exists, and that's what I thought to start with, so I could be okay with that, right? And so this is actually the drawback, the self-identified by Gelugpa's fault of the Gelugpa's way of talking. That, you know, because you're constantly saying, oh, we're not refuting existence, we're refuting intrinsic existence, that then people think, well, that would be okay. I don't know what they mean by it. Some philosophical thing. But I know that they're not telling me that there aren't cars and people and countries like Tibet and, that, you know, right? And so forth. So these things all exist, and Tsongkhapa agrees they exist, so it's all good, right? So the problem, of course, is like that we, starting out, you know, where we have no way to separate our sense of things existing from our sense of things intrinsically existing. What it would mean for something to exist without it being having some nature that allowed it to be what it is very difficult to understand. More, it seems like, oh, you know, you can just say the words, oh, we have a reified sense of how things are, and we need to have a more realistic sense. But when you try to say, well, what would it be like for things to be what they are without having any nature of being that we could point out, it starts to get harder and harder. And it's difficult to say for us what it really means to feel or to see what existence would be without the kind of existence that we always believe in, right? And it's like existence and intrinsic existence, when we stop to think about it, are threaded together, not just like sitting next to each other and you can easily lop off one, but they're threaded together. And so it's like a very difficult operation, right? And if you're going to try to, as a yogi, excise from your own mental continuum this kind of grasping at things having their own nature, but not lop off the things themselves as somehow merely existing without any nature. Yeah. Because, I don't know, it's very difficult. His Holiness has talked about, like, you know, it's like one thing to say that dependent arising is, you know, the same import that as emptiness. And it's another thing that's much more difficult to actually like realize or understand how we can posit one thing as arising in dependence on another when none of these things have any nature that we can find or point out, you know? So that's why it's to be taken seriously. You know what I'm saying? It's not, it's easy to get started on, and harder to get up to the very edge, I guess, is of the ridge. That's, I guess, what I'm saying. So the unfindability of things under analysis, this idea that dependent arising and emptiness and the middle way are all different ways of talking about the same thing. It's repeatedly stated by Nagarjuna, most famously in 18th verse of the 24th chapter of the Fundamental Treatise on the Middle Way, but also in the dedicatory verse of the Refutation of Objections, and like Tsongkhapa quotes three other places where Nagarjuna basically says the same thing. Don't think that emptiness means non-existence. Whatever you think emptiness is, don't think of it as something that eliminates dependent arising. Go with the most radical understanding of emptiness you can manage without contradicting dependent arising. If you come to what you think is an understanding of emptiness, but it seems to destroy dependent arising, then back up. at least for the time being. Emptiness, meaning this unfindability of things under analysis, Nagarjuna is saying, doesn't cash out as being things not existing at all. But somehow, mysteriously, it cashes out as things flowing and working and interacting the way they do now. In other words, what makes it possible for us to live and breathe and talk about emptiness and meditate on the path is the fact that things are empty, right? Dependent arising is working right now, and that's because things are empty, not in spite of it. That's what Nagarjuna teaches that very clearly in the 24th chapter, because like he does this, 23 chapters about empty, everything's empty, this is empty, that's empty, this other thing's empty. And finally, the other Buddhists are freaked out, and, they're saying, you've destroyed the first truth, you've destroyed the second truth, these are all the noble truths wiped out, Buddha three jewels are wiped out, everything's wiped out, you've just said none of these things have any nature whatsoever, you've, destroying Buddhism, you can't possibly be, having any practice. And Nagarjuna said, no, you're destroying it when you keep insisting these things have some intrinsic nature of their own. It's only because they lack intrinsic nature that they're able to function, right? Yeah. So generally speaking, aside from the people who were in the lineage of Nagarjuna, most Buddhists assume just the opposite. I mean, the people that Nagarjuna is criticizing, as I was saying briefly to Tom in the break, is that people Nagarjuna is criticizing represent a lot of Buddhists. That is, that they think that, you can say that things don't ultimately exist. You can say that when we search for things, you don't find them in some sense. But you don't want to say things have no nature. You want to say that something has some nature that, if something doesn't have a certain kind of nature that gives it a power to function as a cause, then how is it going to be a cause for an effect? And then how is dependent arising going to work? And then Nagarjuna and Tsongkhapa say, well, if it had some intrinsic nature as a cause, it would always and forever have to be a cause. It would never have been able to be an effect. And we ought to be able to search under ultimate analysis and say, what is it really? We ought to find its essential causalness. And nothing like this is ever found. And so it has to be that somehow things dependent arising works without things having any nature at all. Yeah. So Tsongkhapa in this section, he says, these other Tibetans who've come around and before him and tried to interpret Chandrakirti, and they say, when we analyze things, we find nothing whatsoever. And therefore, the fact is that nothing actually exists, but we'll pretend like it does out of compassion. He said that's a way to read Chandrakirti that, was popular before Tsongkhapa, maybe for some afterwards. And he criticizes people. He's saying, you're just like these Buddhist realists. You can't separate intrinsically existent nature that's findable under analysis from merely existent. You think the two have to go together. The Buddhist realists are saying, look, things must have some essence, otherwise they wouldn't exist at all, and they have to exist because dependent arising works. That's the Buddhist realists who are criticized in the 24th chapter. Whereas the other followers of Chandrakirti say, no, we're not like those coarse Buddhist realizers, Buddhist realists. we realize that nothing exists. When we analyze it, we find that nothing exists at all. And so, you know, what? Of course, you know, things have no existence. They have no intrinsic existence, because when we, the ultimate mind that searches out in the final analysis, finds, cannot find a trace of them. Right? And so he says, the problem is that you guys have the same idea, that you've said things don't have a findable under the, under analysis kind of nature, then they must not exist. And both the realists and the nihilist interpreters of Chandrakirti agree on that premise. They haven't threaded apart existence from intrinsic existence. So either nothing exists because it has no findable nature, that would be the nihilists, or else things have to have some findable nature because otherwise they wouldn't exist. And so I'm saying, no, you have to like write down there and say, like, even though it's hard for us to figure out, you know, and identify exactly what this means, things have some sort of existence that is enables them to function, and they function precisely because they lack this kind of frozen into place essence that we take it for granted that they have when we think about them and relate to them ordinarily day to day. I have no idea what time it is.
Yeah, I lost time too, but I think we went over.
We went over?
Yeah.
22 minutes.
We went 22 minutes over? Okay.
So
we
have...
Okay, well, let's establish a time to reconvene and then take a little bit.
What time should that be?
Well, you got it.
We'll be cutting in. Tom, you can... You don't have... Can you start a little later? Yeah. We'll do a good... Should we take about a 20-minute break? Is that enough for everyone?
I think 25.
Yep.
What time 25. Do you want to come back?
What time is it now?
It's 10 of, I think.
10 of
3.
Come back at 4:15, is that when you want?
Is that 25? Or?
Yeah.
That's good.
So, 25. A 4:15.
Well, I have
3?
Actually, I have 7 minutes.
We'll reconvene at 3:15.
3:15. We'll do another hour or so.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
Okay.
Thank you, Josh.
Happy
to do it.
Questions?
Yeah, I got one, which I didn't really answer yet. But yeah, if you give me another one, then I'll do part of the next class on that.
You're coming back in 25?